Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is John Owen IV, the Ambassador Henry J. and Mrs. Marion R. Taylor Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia, and a faculty fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. He is also a team member on our project on religious liberty and social flourishing at the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. It's probably a good thing that we don't abbreviate that all, because it would be a very cumbersome acronym. A Harvard PhD, John specializes in international relations and is author of several books, including The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, Transnational Networks, States, and Regime Change, 1510 to 2010, and Liberal Peace, Liberal War, American Politics and International Security. While these titles may not seem to give him the props to be on a podcast about religion, his most recent book, Confronting Political Islam, does inject the topic of religion directly into the world of foreign affairs and makes him an excellent choice to discuss this timely topic of relations between the Christian West and the Muslim Middle East. As always, we will link to his biographical information and writings on our website, and please make it a New Year's resolution to connect with us, Research on Religion, at Facebook and on Twitter. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
So your book, Confronting Political Islam, at first glance appears to be another in an increasingly long string of tactical advice for fighting the war on terror in the 21st century. But there's a little bit more to it, isn't there?
There is, yeah. I'll just mention a couple of things. First, less important, but I'll still mention it. It's not just on the war on terror. It's on political Islam more generally, or as it's often called, Islamism, or Islamism if you prefer. And this is the ideology that underpins jihadist terrorism, but also underpins many regimes and movements in the Muslim world, many of which are not terrorists. In fact, some of the states in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, are Islamist and are quite friendly, or at least have been dealing with the United States cooperatively for many decades. So I'm aiming at a larger phenomenon than terrorism, although terrorism's implicated in this. But more important, though, my book differs from most of the books out there in that, well, let's talk about the subtitle, Six Lessons from the West's Past.
Ah, I did not read the subtitle there in the introduction, and subtitles are important.
They are important, and this one, you know, reveals that I approach Islamism from a different angle. Instead of probing it in isolation the way most scholars do, understandably, I begin by saying Islamism really is a prolonged and really a vast case of something we've seen several times before in the Western world, in Europe and the Americas. Namely, Islamism is a transnational ideological conflict. It's a struggle over the best way to order society, and it stretches across a number of countries at once. It's transnational, it lasts for many decades, and it skews politics both within and among countries in all kinds of ways.
The inclusion of the past, and again, I'm going to read the subtitle now, it's Confronting Political Islam, Six Lessons from the West Past. Well, including the West Pass is really what makes this book truly unique in our contemporary discussions of political Islam or Islamism. And it also makes it a really good and challenging read. And when I say challenging, I don't mean it's difficult to read. You write it in a very accessible way, but it's challenging in that it gets us to examine our modern world in an entirely new light by examining what happened a long time ago. The common saying is history is a great teacher. Moreover, you do something that a lot of other people don't do, and that's you don't take the obvious historical cases, which would be the Crusades starting in 1100. Everybody thinks about that in terms of the West and Islam. You don't take that as a launching point. Instead, you present us with three 16th century rebellions in Scotland, France, and the Netherlands, of all places, as instances that we should learn from in dealing with contemporary Islamism. So explain why you use these three cases of Scotland, France, and the Netherlands, and give us a brief description of what was going on for our listeners, including myself, who didn't even know the Scots were rebellious back then.
Yeah, in a much more serious way than they were earlier this year. So the history of the West I look at is not so much about the West's contact with Islam, although that figures in kind of incidental ways. I'm really looking at the way Westerners treated each other, if you will. So let me jump into this what I think is a fascinating case from Northwest Europe way back in the 1560s, okay? All three of these countries, Scotland, France, and the Netherlands, were monarchies, all had rebellions at roughly the same time, led by nobles, aristocrats, and the main leaders in each of these rebellions were Calvinists. That is, they were adherents to the branch of Protestantism founded by John Calvin a couple of decades earlier. Calvin was very much alive at the time in Geneva, which was a free city. Calvinism was a transnational movement. That is, it was a highly cohesive network of clergy and nobles that stretched across a number of countries in northern and western Europe. It was very anti-Catholic at this point in history, militantly so. Geneva was the nerve center of Calvinism, and Calvin's followers in one country communicated both with Calvin and Theodore Beza and others in Geneva, but also with each other. So Scots Calvinists and Dutch Calvinists had contact with each other. This is, so before the internet, before there was texting, you could still do this sort of communication. It was slower, but they had the printing press, and it was relatively easy to move across national boundaries in this era. So,
did kids walk around with printing presses in their hand, always looking down on the street?
Yeah, and parents said, the kids these days, printing presses, not like when I was young. Yeah. Let me just say more broadly, and a lot of listeners will know this, but just for the record, across most of northern and western Europe, there were deep divides over religion that had been going on for decades, beginning with the Lutheran Reformation, started in 1517. I call this an ideological struggle, because I'm a political scientist like you. Religious questions at this time in Europe really were political questions as well. Church and state were a lot more mingled then than now. So the political question was, which shall be the established religion in our state, and by implication, which religions or which branches of Christianity are we going to disallow? Because these were principled, intolerant religious movements, if you will. So the first rebellion was in Scotland. Scotland was then a separate kingdom from England. It was ruled by a queen regent from France who was a devout Catholic. So Scotland was sort of under French hegemony at the time. But Scotland was facing a growing Calvinist movement among its nobility. And in 1558, in England, south of the border, Queen Mary Tudor, who was a militant Catholic, died, and her half-sister Elizabeth Tudor, a Protestant, took the throne. In 1559, Elizabeth reestablished the Protestant faith as the official religion of England, and this energized the Scots Calvinists north of the border in Scotland. They broke out in rebellion against the French Queen Regent. They hoped to establish a Calvinist state and establish some kind of union with England, which was now the Protestant champion of Europe. And the Presbyterians, they were called, and Scotland had some early successes in their civil war up there. Then they hit a stalemate. And Catholic France, sent troops to Scotland to try to help the Queen Regent. England counter-intervened, sent troops north to Scotland to help the Calvinist rebels, and the latter won. They set up a reformed or Calvinist realm in Scotland, and they signed a treaty of alliance with England in 1561. So that's case number one. In France, situation was similar. Catholic country ruled by a queen regent also had a growing Calvinist movement called the Huguenots. And the queen regent in France had granted the Huguenots some limited toleration in January 1562, just after the events I've just narrated in Scotland. In March of 1562, one of the great noble families of France, the Guises, who were militantly Catholic, massacred a group of Huguenot worshippers, and a month later, the Huguenot nobles issued a general mobilization, and civil war broke out in France, and this was Calvinist versus Catholic. And these were, they were horrible, went on for 30 years in several phases, but in any case, here again, Elizabeth up in England intervened. She sent troops to France to help the Huguenots. She had had success doing that in Scotland. This time, the English intervention did not work, and the Huguenots did not win in France. So that's case number two. Number three, the Netherlands, also in the 1560s. The Netherlands, which actually covers now both the Netherlands and Belgium today, ruled by Spain at the time, and Spain was a very Catholic country. Netherlands also had a healthy and growing cohort of Calvinists, especially among elites. And the king of Spain was deeply worried about this. He had observed what had happened in Scotland and in France and thought, these Calvinists are no good, they're going to rebel. So he ordered an Inquisition in the Netherlands. And this is not the Spanish Inquisition made famous by Monty Python. This was much more serious. And the Dutch Calvinists did not react kindly, and a revolt broke out in 1567, led by Calvinists. And the English, here again, sent troops to the Netherlands to help them. The Huguenots in France sent troops, and some German Calvinists all intervened to help the Dutch Calvinists. And this time it worked. The Dutch did set up a separate country independent from Spain. So the main point here, all this history and all these rebellions, is to say there was a lot of unrest in northwestern Europe during those years that involved rebellion, revolution, foreign intervention. And this is a lot like some episodes over the last 80 years or so in the Muslim world, which brings us to political Islam today. You know, across the Middle East, into South Asia, North and Central Africa, even stretching into Southeast Asia, there has been for decades a long struggle over ideology, over the best way to order Muslim societies. And this has featured transnational networks, kind of like that Calvinist network I mentioned, periodic rebellions, revolutions, waves of foreign intervention. In the Muslim case today, the basic struggle is between Islamists and secularists. And these are terms that disguise a lot of complexity. There are lots of different types of Islamists, some of which are enemies with one another. But think about, just quickly, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the regional unrest and the war that it helped to trigger. Or think about the aftermath of the Arab Spring just a few years ago with a chain of rebellions and Islamists winning some elections, then being toppled in Egypt by secularists, the descent into civil war in Syria, and so on. So the analogy with Northwest Europe in the 1560s is certainly not exact. For example, Europe did not have what we call seculars yet, but I still think there's a lot to it that we can learn from.
Yeah, I want to repeat and emphasize how novel this approach is. It's very common to hear pundits say that you cannot compare apples and oranges, which I've always taken as ridiculous because whenever I go to the store, I actually compare apples and oranges in the produce section. And I also have a little bit of history with this because I wrote a paper comparing 19th century Mexico with 20th century Iran, and the reviewers came back saying, you can't do this. You just can't compare a Catholic nation 100 years ago with a Muslim nation today. That's just absolutely silly. So how did you come about making this comparison? How do you justify this comparison? And did you get any pushback from people saying, you cannot compare apples and oranges?
You're right, even though it's all fruit. Yeah, I did. First of all, let me say, of course, these are vastly different times and places in many ways. I mean, I alluded to this a minute ago, but Christianity is not Islam. Europe is not the Middle East. The 16th century is not the 21st century. Grant all of that. But, you know, if you look at this empirically, there are striking resemblances. You know, again, serial rebellions, foreign interventions, transnational networks. So what I do in the book is say, let's take into account the differences, yes, but let's abstract from the contents of these religions and ideologies and just see how far we get in understanding and explaining what's going on. You know, there's this wonderful quotation attributed to Mark Twain, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that sums it up. And I have gotten some resistance, Tony, as you have some resistance. Not so much from comparing these two periods, early modern Europe and the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, but from some of the later analogies I draw, say with communism and capitalism and so on. So some people think that the cases I've just described are really about religion, not about political regimes. And I say they're about both, because we have to be careful not to project the modern separation of church and state onto the 16th century that didn't know that separation.
What motivated you to write this book? I mean, it's, now that you talk about it, it seems like an obvious comparison, and I think you can justify it very well. I would support you in making this comparison, but you know, you're somebody who's an international relations guy. Why all of a sudden did you pick this topic? Was there looking for something to do, kicked a stone and found it, or what?
Yeah. Well, one of my books you mentioned earlier, The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, I published that in 2010. And that, by the way, is a social science monograph, complete with jargon and ponderous theory. That book offers an explanation for 500 years of foreign intervention. That book, though, forced me to look at, to my surprise, transnational ideological movements over the centuries. And as I was finishing that up, and I was talking to some colleagues, various colleagues, at least a couple of colleagues said, you know, you should think about writing something for a more general audience about political Islam and what's been going on in the Muslim world, because there are some similarities. And in fact, that earlier book has a chapter on political Islam. And I like this idea of doing a more general book without the jargon, because I thought, first of all, Islamism is not going away anytime soon, and that's something maybe we can talk about later. In the years after the 9/11 attacks and the Iraq and Afghan wars, Americans still remained baffled by Islamism, you know, thinking these people are just irrational fanatics, this can't last, we don't understand it. I thought, you know, we can learn a lot from our own. Let's not forget that in the West, we've gone through a number of similar periods, rough patches that went for several decades, even a century or more, and we can learn from that. So I really thought that I had something to bring to the table that wasn't being brought by other people.
Yeah, and you do a really good job of it. I tend to like the style of writing that you have in this book, because it does make the topic more accessible and it really avoids the jargon. I'm actually looking at a copy of your book right now, and I hadn't noticed this before, but it's a very creative cover. You have the title in a little red box, and then there's a picture of be an Arab Spring movement march or protest going on. And that's what originally captures your eyes. But in the background of the book is this very light imprint of, I guess it would be a French Huguenot or, you know, Presbyterian rebellion in Scotland or something like that.
Right. I wish I could take credit for that cover. I did suggest kind of a montage, juxtaposition of one of my historical Western conflicts and the Arab Spring. And they took that and ran with it. And yeah, I like the cover. The background is it's 19th century, one of the European revolutions of the 19th century. But yeah, it's I'm glad you find the book accessible. That's the idea. This really is meant for a more a thoughtful general audience that's not trying to fight methodological battles within social science.
Yeah, and again, I'm going to emphasize, this is a really neat cover now that I look at it. I mean, most academic book covers suck, but this one's a good one. You lucked out, because most people...
Oh, good. Yeah, I'll pass the word on to my editor.
Yeah, because most people, you know, most authors, they can't connect with the people who are making the book covers, and it comes out really weird. But talking about the general ideas behind this book, and ideas is an important word here, because you place a lot of emphasis on the role of ideas or ideologies or theologies. Yeah. And although in my own work, I admit that ideas matter, you know, I'm obviously in the business of trying to convince people of the validity of my theories here in academia. Personally, I tend to place more emphasis on the role of interest when it comes to motivating human behavior than ideas. And I tend to see ideas as more malleable and often used sometimes in very ex post facto ways to justify behavioral outcomes. The old fox and the grape story, the Aesop fable, where the fox loves grapes, can't get to the grapes, but then leaves and says, I never really liked grapes anyways. You could take the idea of not liking grapes as a justification for the fact that he was facing a constraint and couldn't get there. So here's what I want you to do for a little bit, is to make a case for the importance of ideas in motivating behavior, specifically with relation to the high politics of social rebellions or foreign affairs?
Yeah, great question. You know, I am one of those social scientists who think that ideas are consequential because we use them to interpret the material and social world. In other words, interests and ideas are entangled, endogenous. It's difficult to disentangle these things. So, I mean, that's really a philosophical position, probably impossible to disprove, and not exactly what you're asking, but just to get that on the table. That's how I approach it. So I just sort of assume that ideas matter as well as interest. But let me get to your this specific point about the malleability of ideas and ideologies. And you know, there are people who have a strong commitment to a set of ideas, and there are other people who are more weakly committed to a set of ideas. So, I think, you know, we know of certain people we might even call zealots in history. That's an unkind term, but I'll use it for the time being. So I think of someone like Martin Luther, famous, who inaugurated the Reformation, famous for saying at a tribunal, in the end, here I stand, I can do no other. And he really took on a lot of risk by saying that. It would have been, you could make a case that Luther, at that point, had an interest in some kind of compromise and saying, okay, I've made my point, let's cut a deal, you know, to the cardinals and to the Catholic Church hierarchy. That's not what he did. And you can tell an interest-based story that says, well, he didn't do it because it was in his interest not to do it. But I think it's better to say he was really committed to this set of ideas, this set of doctrines that he saw in the Bible and that he really thought the Catholic Church had drifted away from and was going against. And he was willing to pay the ultimate price if it came to that. Now, not everybody's Martin Luther. There's a reason why the Reformation took a long time to happen, and a lot of people are, you know, interested in a lot of things, and they have, they're not willing to go to the mat or pay the ultimate price for a particular set of ideas, even religious ideas. And so, in other words, the world's a very complicated place. It's heterogeneous in terms of individuals' commitments to ideas, including ideologies. And so I think that the way this all comes out in the mix is very complicated, but you can have certain moments or periods in history when the people who are extremely devoted to a set of ideas get a large following, a real head of steam, and are highly consequential. And we associate those with times of revolution. If you think of the Reformation as a kind of religious revolution, or you think of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini certainly is thinking about the interest, his own interest in the interest of his regime. He's also heavily committed to a set of ideas and completely unwilling to compromise on some of those ideas.
Your case of Martin Luther is, I think, a very good example to illustrate this, and I applaud you for doing that. And also for bringing this point up into international affairs, because international affairs is oftentimes dominated by a perspective known as realism, which really takes interest as the core. And a lot of the rhetoric, at least among think tanks or people trying to figure out how do we deal with political Islam here, tends to be rooted in this interest-based thing. You tend to think of, well, there's this Arab Spring rebellion going on. Well, they just want access to the halls of power. Or there's this Al-Qaeda movement. Well, they just want this piece of territory. Or ISIS wants this piece of territory. And if we just map out this piece of territory and say, okay, here you have it, everything is good and fine. But if you ignore the ideological dimension of this, you're really not seeing the whole picture.
That's right. I mean, one current example, a colleague of mine at UC Berkeley, Ron Hastner, has written about is sacred spaces. So think about Jerusalem, especially the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. You know, we might want to sit down with Jews and Arabs and say, look, guys, it's just divided up somehow, okay? Just, you know, split it down the middle or do a timeshare or something. Come on, you know, let's be rational here. There are people on either side who probably would be willing to do that if the truth were known, but there are a lot of people who won't. They simply will not. They're so committed to that piece of territory as being central to their religion that they can't and won't compromise. And that is extremely consequential for international politics. It has been for the last several decades.
Yeah, we have had Ron Hastner discuss that on a previous podcast, and we will link back to that. It's a great interview, and it really gels well with what you're doing here.
Yeah,
let me just give you a little gotcha point, because again, I'm more interest-based analysis and kind of fall into the realist camp a little bit more if I did international relations. And there's a little bit of a gotcha moment I had here in the book. You were talking about the importance of ideas, and then when talking about the rebellion between the French Huguenots and the Catholics in the mid-1600s, you mentioned that Henry IV, a Huguenot champion, agreed to convert to Catholicism so as to make Paris unopposed. And there it seems that at this very high end of politics, the can you have Paris, this very central city, ideas became very flexible. Saying, well, okay, I can do the whole Catholic thing as so long as I get all these wonderful cafes on the River Seine. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, you know, Paris is a special place, I guess. No. That's a great, it's a great gotcha point. Henry IV, Henry Navarre, is an interesting guy and regarded, it's called Henry the Great still in France because he put the interest of France above that of religion, or his particular religious group or sect. I would just go back to the point I made earlier. Henry is a certain type of leader, and perhaps people like that, by and large, succeed in politics more than the people committed so deeply to a particular religious group or religious doctrine or ideology. Just to make the point again, Henry's not the only type of leader out there. A generation before, the Holy Roman Emperor and King of Spain, Charles V, was a devout Catholic and had a number of opportunities to compromise with Luther and the Lutherans. And he actually did think about it, but he could not bring himself to grant them permanent toleration. He, in fact, tricked them and inaugurated a religious war against them in the 1540s. At great cost, and he ended up losing a follow-up war and abdicated. So he's one of these people who, he's an effective leader, certainly self-interested, a military leader, but at the end of the day, he probably miscalculated on how to handle the Lutherans because he was so devoted to the teachings of the Church of Rome. I have some other cases in the book. I want to mention the small German state called the Palatinate in which doesn't exist anymore in modern Germany, but the rulers from the late 16th century into the early 17th century were militant Calvinists and really punched above their weight. There were Frederick the Fourth, Frederick the Fifth, and so on. Finally, they overreached and helped trigger the 30 Years' War in 1618, and I won't go into detail, but a lot of historians think they just got carried away, and they were so anti-Catholic that they thought they were being self-interested in doing some things, and it turns out they really were lapsing into irrationality. And it was highly consequential for international politics at the time. So again, heterogeneity. Henry IV is one type of leader, but we've got plenty of others out there as well who are much more committed to the ideas.
Yeah, that is a very good point. And again, I like your instance of Martin Luther, and you could almost contrast it with Jan Hus as well, who was very ideologically committed and burned for his ideas because he wouldn't compromise. And there are those folks out there, and there are the ones who, like Henry IV, back down. So ideas matter. You got me sold on that now. I'm good with that. Let's go ahead and look at your comparative lessons from the West Pass and talk about it with relationship to our contemporary world. First of all, I want you to talk about the contemporary world and what do you mean by political Islam, and also talk about the geographical scope of your book, because while Islam extends from Morocco to Malaysia, you tend to limit it a little bit more geographically. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, good. So first, political Islam or Islamism. Yeah, I haven't defined them yet here, have I? So by Islamism, I just mean a general ideology to establish, or some would say reestablish, Islamic law, also known as Sharia, here on earth, at least in societies where Muslims live, and for some Islamists, eventually they want to do this over the entire globe, you know, the more radical Islamists. Islamic law, or Sharia, is derived from the sacred texts of Islam, the Quran and the Hadith, or the sayings of the Prophet. And there are a number of different Hadiths. Different Muslims accept different Hadiths as authoritative. Islamism is complex. It's multiform, comes in a lot of different versions. First of all, there are Shia Islamists centered in Iran, but they live elsewhere. Then there are Sunni Islamists, and Shia and Sunni, most listeners will at least be familiar with this, are the two main branches of Islam, a little bit analogous to Catholic Protestant or Catholic Eastern Orthodox, but not fully analogous. Within Shia Islamism and Sunni Islamism especially, there are several variations, and some of these Islamists are enemies with each other. So the claim I'm making, a lot of other people make as well, there is something called Islamism. Don't take that to mean all Islamists are friendly with each other or reading off the same page, but they are, in a very general sense, trying to do the same thing, especially when you compare them to the secularists. And secularism in the Muslim world has a particular meaning. It's a counter-ideology. It says that law should not come from religious sources, the Quran, the Hadith, but instead should come from supposedly unaided reason, experience, logic, science. Secularism really came to the Muslim world through European colonization in the 19th century and gained a lot of steam in the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century with the so-called Young Turks movement. And these were people who saw that the Ottoman Empire, which was centered in Turkey but ruled a lot of the Middle East and had once been a great power, by the late 19th century was called the sick man of Europe. The Young Turks said, what's wrong with the Ottoman Empire? Well, it's that we're too Islamic. We're too traditional Islamic. We need to become modern and secular like the Europeans. Then we'll be great again. And in the early 20th century, they tried to implement some reforms. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire was on the losing side, and a young military officer called Ataturk, Mustafa Kemal overthrew the Ottoman Empire and set up the modern secular Republic of Turkey. And he said, Turkey is going to be is not going to be one of these traditional religious states. We're going to be like a European state, powerful, secular, rational, modern, scientific. And Ataturk had imitators in the Persian world, in Iran, in South Asia. So the founder of Pakistan was, Jinnah was heavily influenced by Ataturk. And Ataturk also had influence in the Arab world. There were a number of Arab secularists who said, you know, Ataturk's right about this. If we're going to get out from under the heel of the Europeans, we have to become like them. We have to become secular. This traditional Islam has held us back. So they, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, had the upper hand. And then there was pushback from traditional Muslims in most of these societies who said, you know, this secularism is all wrong. It is making it very hard to live as a pious, faithful Muslim, living under these secular laws and rulers. We need to return to traditional Islam, where the law is given by Allah, where it's not derived from secular reason. And that there you have forming in the middle of the 20th, early middle 20th century, this ideological contest that is still going. It's almost wherever you find Muslims, I won't say everywhere, but even in Western cities, you often find Islamists and secularists tussling at odds with each other. Certainly in the reasons you mentioned from North Africa to Southeast Asia. In this book, I focus on the Middle East and North Africa and some of Southwest Asia just because I had to confine myself geographically to some extent to make the book tractable, manageable. Also, most of the action, frankly, the ideological action, has been happening in the Middle East and Southwest Asia and North Africa, and that's why I focus. I think what happens there has huge ramifications for other Muslim regions of the world, including Southeast Asia. So I decided to focus my attention strategically.
Yeah, there are two different types of books, finished and unfinished, and it's always good to have the finished. Okay, you laid out the case here for the ascendancy of political Islam in light of this battle with secularism, and your book spends its time basically contrasting this, what happened some 500 years or so earlier, and you divide the book into six chapters, each with a specific lesson, which is custom made for a podcast here, because we can go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and...
Yeah, happy to be of service.
Yeah, no, that's great, which makes it very organized, right? Love that. We might not be able to get through all the 6 points here, but let's cover each one of them. Some of them we've already touched upon, but I'll give you a chance to go into greater detail. And do this in a way that brings the past up to date with the present and blends these two for our important lessons. The first chapter, it's Don't Sell Islamism Short, which goes back to a point that you were making earlier, that Islamism is probably not going to be going away anytime soon. So explain that in relation to history.
One thing that surprised me as I began to research this book was how many people involved in the debates over Islamism in this country and in Europe, including experts on Islamism, people who know much more about Islam than I do, kept prophesying a quick demise of Islamism. In other words, especially of radical jihadism, terrorism, but also of the underlying ideology of Islamism, you know, the positive program that these folks have in mind. They really, and I have chapter and verse in the book on this, people who say, you know, 9/11 is not a sign of strength, it's a sign of a desperate movement that's really on its way out. In some sense, I suppose that's the case, but, you know, now it is more than a decade later, and radical Islam seems as powerful as ever in the Middle East. And I say in the book a little bit about what I think is going on here, why we short-sell Islamism. I think part of it is, it just says a lot about us. We in the secular liberal West, and I use those terms. I'm myself a religious believer, but I'm also a Westerner. I live in a secular liberal society. We have trouble believing that an ideology that seems so backward is going to last. You know, we think surely an attempt to retrieve religious law from 1,400 years ago is going to fail. Surely this can't handle the 20th century. Modern technology, the scientific method, democracy, the internet, you name it. We just think it can't work. And I remember way back in high school, I was in high school in 1979 when the Iranian Revolution took place, and I remember I was taking a world civilizations class at the time, and my teacher said, this revolution is baffling. It's trying to pull Iran back to the Middle Ages. And that quotation has stuck with me ever since. There's a little truth to that, but at the same time, Islamists think of themselves as progressive, not in the Western liberal sense of progressive, but they really think that history is on their side, not on our side. We have trouble seeing that. It sounds preposterous to us to say Islamism is progressive. I think that one of the secrets of Islamism is that it's been underestimated by secularists, both Muslim secularists like Ataturk and Jinnah and Nasser in Egypt, but also us. That's one of its secrets, and it's caused us to overlook its strength. Now, in the book, I give some examples, some analogs from history. And let me just go over one, an ideology that was sold short by its opponents. This example's not from the 16th century Catholic Protestant struggles I was talking about a few minutes ago. This example's from another of my historical analogies. This is a long struggle that began in the 1770s in Europe and the Americas. And the contending ideologies were monarchism and republicanism. Monarchists believed that government should be headed by a ruler who inherited his rule. And republicans believed, by contrast, that government should be elected and accountable. Now, ironically, it's ironic now in the 21st century, monarchists really thought that republicanism was going to fail, that it was a loser ideology. Republics, they thought, can't succeed. They thought they knew from history that republics always degenerate into chaos, civil war, dictatorship. This happened in ancient Rome. The Roman Republic eventually became a dictatorship. Or more recently, France. France had a revolution in 1789. It descended into chaos and violence. Finally, Napoleon Bonaparte took over 10 years later in 1799 and became a kind of dictator. So traditional monarchists in Europe said that, you know, there you go, it happens every time. After Napoleon was finally defeated in 1815, European monarchists were pretty confident that the liberal and republican movements that had propelled the French Revolution in the preceding decades were done. You know, everyone now sees that liberalism, republicanism doesn't work, and so monarchies will survive. The problem is they were wrong. After Napoleon was defeated, liberals weren't done. Liberal networks crisscrossed Europe. They kept communicating with each other, plotting, supporting each other. And on several occasions in the early 19th century, there were outbreaks of revolt and revolution that spread across parts of Europe. In the early 1820s, there was one of these. 10 years later, the early 1830s, there was a second wave of revolt. And the big one that lots of people are familiar with was in 1848. This is the third big wave. Toppled governments all over Europe, really, really knocked the monarchists back on their heels. Now, eventually, liberalism and republicanism did win in Europe and the Americas. And I don't mean to say Islamism is going to win in the Muslim world. My point here is just that an ideology that seems impractical and even doomed to its opponents may actually live a long time, especially if it has state sponsors that provide transnational networks with moral and material support that create conditions for the ideology to flourish. And I get into this in some of the other lessons in the book. But that's the basic lesson here. Don't short sell an ideology just because it doesn't make sense to you.
Yeah, I think that is a very important lesson. And we see that all the time, too, in religion studies, where people are thinking, well, religion's done. God is dead. End of story. Move on. And then all of a sudden, there's a Pentecostal revival. There's an Islam revival. There's a Hindu revival, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
We oftentimes think that. And it's an indication of us scholars, too. We live in our own bubbles, and we need to get out of those bubbles at some point in time. Let me go ahead and skip a chapter, because you just brought this up about issues of state sponsors. And one of my favorite chapters in the book has to deal with foreign interventions. And you say that the lesson from the past for today is that foreign interventions are normal. Discuss that.
Yeah. Well, here I'll start out by saying many critics of the U.S.-led war in Iraq, and I'm among those critics. There's a lot to criticize. But many critics go all the way with their criticism and say that the war itself, that is the U.S.-led war to topple Saddam Hussein and so on, was irrational. It doesn't make sense. It's a product of the Bush administration's, you know, fill-in-the-blank, hysteria, paranoia, Bush's desire to avenge his father. It was imperialism, whatever. But it's not a rational thing. It's not normal statecraft. It's just kind of an aberration. But here again, Western history shows that in times and places that have these long, deep ideological struggles that cut across an entire region, you're just going to get a lot of foreign interventions. I already mentioned a few minutes ago a great case from Northwestern Europe in the 1560s, these revolts in Scotland, France, and the Netherlands. All three of these, I mentioned, attracted foreign intervention. England intervened in all three of these countries. Now, it's worth asking why they do this. Is it just they get all excited and, hey, there's a rebellion, let's go get involved in the action? Well, it is more rational than that, and I think there are two incentives that foreigners have to intervene in other states during these periods of ideological struggle. Both of these incentives derive from the fact that ideologies are transnational. That is to say, there are people in several states at once that adhere to this ideology. And the first incentive is this. A foreign government can gain an ally or keep an ally in a neighboring state by intervening to put its ideological brethren in power. So, again, think about Protestant England in the 1560s. Why did Elizabeth in England, with the support of her Privy Council, her cabinet, send troops north to Scotland? Well, because she knew that the Scottish Protestants, the Presbyterians, were very pro-English. They were pro-English because they regarded England under Elizabeth as their champion. And so Elizabeth knew, well, those are our guys in Scotland. If we help them gain power, we'll probably get an ally out of this. Scotland's pretty important. It's a small country, but it's on our northern border. And right now, Scotland is under the hegemony of our rival France. That's bad. If we help set the Protestants up in Scotland, France loses Scotland and we gain Scotland. And that's exactly what happened. So I think the incentive is pretty clear why Elizabeth did it. It wasn't just Protestant zeal. In fact, in her case, I think, Tony, Elizabeth probably is more like Henry IV. She wasn't that zealous a Protestant, but she understood statecraft pretty well. So there's one incentive to help, and this is why she did it in France and the Netherlands as well. The second incentive that a government has to intervene during these periods of ideological struggle is about domestic security. And here, rather than go through an abstract explanation, let me just talk about the English case a little more. Okay, that's something I didn't mention before. England, when Elizabeth became queen in late 1558, England didn't suddenly become thoroughly Protestant. The Catholics didn't just go away or convert to Protestantism en masse. There were many remaining Catholic nobles. They didn't like Elizabeth, and they, as Elizabeth knew, they were plotting her overthrow, and she faced this problem throughout her reign. These Roman Catholic English were in contact with French, Spanish, Irish, Scottish Catholics to help overthrow Elizabeth. So Elizabeth also had the following incentive. She knew that if she promoted Protestantism in Scotland and France and the Netherlands, which was ruled by Spain, it would weaken Catholicism in England itself. It would do that by showing, by removing some of the moral support that the English Catholics got from foreign Catholics. It would also show that Protestant England was strong and was able to push around its neighbors and gain allies and so on. And I also see this in a lot of other cases, that these foreign interventions happen because, in part because of a desire for domestic security. So here we can think about let's think about the Arab Spring and the interventions that have happened since then. The Arab Spring being the set of revolts that started in late 2010 in Tunisia, spread through northern Africa and into the Middle East in early 2011. We've seen some foreign interventions there, and one of those has been in the Syrian civil war. Syria is a majority Sunni country, but it's governed by a Muslim sect called Alawites, who are more or less Shia. So it's, if you want to oversimplify a little bit, it's a Sunni Arab country governed by a Shia minority. And during the civil war, Iran has been intervening, not by invasion, but it sent special forces, let's call them, the Quds force, to Syria to help the Shia government stay in power. Saudi Arabia and a number of the Gulf states have sent lots of money to the Syrian rebels, who are Sunni, many of whom are Sunni Islamists, and many of whom, as we now know, are extremists, Sunni jihadist extremists. Why are they doing this? Well, partly out of ideological zeal, but partly because there are geopolitical stakes. If the Syrian Shia government, Alawite government, falls to the Sunnis, it's a net loss for Iran and a net gain for Saudi Arabia. If the Syrian government survives, Iran gets to keep its ally, Syria, and Saudi Arabia loses an opportunity. And the Saudis really, really hate the Syrian regime, and they really, really hate Iran. So we're changing, you know, this is 500 years later. It's the Middle East, not Europe. But I'm seeing a lot of similarities, similar dynamics, and it helps make sense of these foreign interventions. They just happen in times and places where you have these ideological struggles.
And this also goes to the point of one of your other points or lessons that you make, and this was in the second chapter, that ideologies are not monolithic, that we're not just dealing with Calvinism or Islamism, but that there are multiple factions within this. Go ahead and discuss that a bit.
Yeah. Well, another lesson of history is that opponents of an ideology often argue over whether that ideology is monolithic, that is to say, a single unified thing, or polylithic, and that really is a word. I didn't know it was a word, but I discovered it when I was writing the book. And a polylith, a monolith, is actually a stone monument that is from a single piece of stone. A polylith is a stone monument that's from several pieces of stone somehow fused together. So a polylithic ideology is an ideology whose adherents can be divided, can be hived off from one another. A monolithic ideology is one where you cannot, if you're an outsider, you can't pit one side against the other. So with Islamism today, some in the West say that it's essentially a single movement, and we need to treat it as a single movement. We should not try to divide and conquer Islamists. We should not ever try to cooperate with any of them. They're all the enemy. They all hate us. They all want to overthrow our system, et cetera, et cetera. Other analysts say No, we should. Islamism is polylithic. In fact, maybe there might not be such a thing as Islamism. It's just there are lots of Islamisms, and we can pit one against the other. We can cooperate with some. So, you know, those are two positions. Well, here again, we can learn from the history of the West, and I'm going to introduce yet another of my big historical cases here. This one is most familiar. This is the struggle in the 20th century that really spanned most of the globe, and there were three ideological contestants in this one: liberal democracy, communism, and fascism. And fascism, of course, was done in by the Second World War, leaving only two contestants, liberal democracy and capitalism on the one hand, and communism on the other. Now, at the end of the Second World War, American policymakers, facing, you know, the collapse of fascism, but therefore the rise of communism in Europe, really had to grapple with this question: is the European left monolithic, or is it polylithic? Europe, Central and Western Europe, Southern Europe, had communist parties, and it had lots of socialist parties as well. And there were some Americans at the time, and I mean here in 1945, 46, 47, 48, who saw the European left as a monolith. Communist, socialist, doesn't matter. They all hate free markets. The socialists, the communists are just socialists in a hurry. We can't work with any of these people. Now, that was a one position. Harry Truman and his administration, Truman was president at the time, took a more nuanced view that I think was the right one. I think they showed great success. The Truman administration believed basically that it depends. Some European socialists were in fact anti-communists, and we can work with them. And the Truman people studied various European socialist parties and their leaders, and they looked for socialists they could cultivate. So let me give you three little case studies here that I talk about in the book. First is Italy. And in Italy, after World War II, socialists and communists were indistinguishable. The left in Italy really was monolithic. They were all pro-Stalin. And the Americans got this and refused to work with any of them. And the Italian socialists made this very clear. They weren't being secretive about it. They liked Stalin. They were in a popular front with the communists and so on. So what the Truman administration did in Italy was, is that we're not going to work with the socialists or the communists because they want to align Italy with the Soviet Union. We're going to cultivate the Christian Democrats and the liberals. And the liberals were a very small party, but the big non-leftist party was the Christian Democrats. So we're a little suspicious of the Americans, but the two did a deal and had a very successful relationship, and Italy ended up joining NATO and becoming a staunch member of the Western Alliance. So that's Italy. France, to the north, was different. Here, the French had a very strong communist party that had a lot of influence in the labor unions, but France also had a strong socialist party. And unlike in Italy, the French socialists were anti-communist. And so, and also in France, the Party of the Right, which included Charles de Gaulle, tended to be a kind of anti-American. They didn't really like the fact that the United States was now the leading power in the Western world. And so the Americans weren't sure they could deal with the French right of center at that point. So what the Truman people did is they cultivated the French socialists. Léon Blum was elderly at the time, but he had been the leader of the French socialists in the 30s. He spent some time in the United States, and he and the French socialists cooperated with the United States in building NATO. And quite a nice relationship the two countries had. So we see a very different attitude Truman people took toward socialists and therefore the European left in those two countries. And the third case is Germany, where the socialists or social democrats were anti-communists. They also were pretty anti-American. So the Americans worked with the Christian Democrats in Germany as they did in Italy. So the lesson here is do what Truman did in his administration, be closely monitor Islamists, look for people you can cultivate, look for opportunities to cooperate, but don't expect too much. And in fact, the United States has been doing this for decades. I mentioned a minute ago, the Saudi regime is extremely Islamist, but it has cooperated with the United States for many decades. America has even cooperated with Iran, first of all, against the Taliban in 2001, 2002, and now, tacitly, reluctantly, against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. The lesson is not, oh, everything is going to be fine if we just work with these Islamists. No, it's take care. Some of them really are implacable enemies, but some of them see some common interest, and you can work with them. But you have to be very careful about this.
Mm-hmm. We are running short of time here, and we have three more points that you make in your book, which we've touched on some, such as states may be rational and ideological at the same time.
Yeah.
You have a fifth chapter, which is that the winner may be none of the above. And now that's intriguing. I'm not going to cover that because I want people to pick up your book and figure out what you're talking about there. So that's a little bit of a teaser. I do want to end here, though, with your sixth chapter, or your sixth lesson, I should say, which is watch Turkey and Iran, because this kind of gets us thinking a little bit about what might be in the future there, and also might springboard us back to that idea that the winner might be none of the above. So explain what you mean by watch Turkey and Iran.
Yeah. Well, earlier I said that an ideology like Islamism can last a long time and longer than we think, and one reason for that is that it can have state sponsors or countries that exemplify the ideology in action. For Islamism, one exemplar has been Iran, and ISIS, in fact, is trying to become a state exemplar for Sunni Islamism. I call these exemplary states. They're sort of test cases for an ideology. So if the ideology, be it Islamism or communism or monarchism, what have you, if it's as good as its partisans say, then states that exemplify it should succeed. And by succeed, I just mean be secure, be prosperous, be culturally impressive, be powerful, and so on. And the history of ideological contests in the West bears this out. And an obvious and familiar case is the end of the Cold War. By the mid-1980s, the United States was clearly outperforming the Soviet Union, and that meant not only that liberal democracy and capitalism were outperforming communism, it meant that Soviet communists and communist elites in what we then call the Third World were giving up on communism. They realized the game was up. I want to mention, if there's time, another case from the old Catholic Protestant struggles that I led with. Today Europeans are largely secular. There are Catholics and Protestants in Europe, but they haven't been fighting each other, except in Northern Ireland, for a long time. What happened? What happened to these struggles four and five centuries ago? Who won? Well, neither branch of Christianity won, and what happened instead was a new political regime took shape in the 17th century, which we call usually secular or tolerant. This is a regime in which the state still had an established religion, but it stopped enforcing religious conformity, and instead it allowed lots of different religions to flourish as long as their adherents were loyal to the state. And this tolerant, or if you want to call it secular, regime took hold in the Netherlands first in the 17th century, first in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, and then in the rest of the country. The Netherlands remained a Calvinist state, but it allowed non-Calvinist Protestants and then Catholics and Jews and others to practice and believe as they liked. And the Netherlands in the 17th century became a fabulous success. It defied most prophecies at the time that it was going to fail. The Netherlands was geographically vulnerable and small, but it defended itself well against Spain and France. It became the richest country per capita in Europe through trade. It was domestically stable. And other Europeans in England and France and Germany wanted to know why. What's up with the Dutch? Why are they punching above their weight? And the English in particular, I write about, we're quite curious. How can we become, you know, we're being beaten by the Dutch in foreign trade. What's going on here? Many English writers visited the Netherlands and looked around, poked around. One of the answers the English settled on was Dutch toleration. The Dutch don't waste resources on combating heresy. They just tolerate religious minorities. They do business together, and look what happens. So the Netherlands was an early exemplar of this new political regime of toleration, and England actually imitated the Netherlands starting in 1689 and became much more tolerant of dissent. So back to the Islamic world today. What does it have to do with Turkey and Iran? Well, Iran, as I said a minute ago, has presented itself since 1979 as the model for Islamism. Its model has had some limited appeal because it's Shia, not Sunni, but it has had a lot of influence and a big following in places like Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, even in some of the Gulf states, and even some in Egypt. Is Iran a successful state? Well, it had a pretty good run from 2002 or so to 2011, but it's been hit hard by the Arab Spring and by economic sanctions because of its nuclear program. So I'm not sure Iran, as an exemplar for Islamism, is doing very well. And by my argument, Islamism itself, at least the Iranian brand, is not enjoying a great run right now. What about Turkey? Well, Turkey is very interesting. Constitutionally, still a secular state founded by Ataturk many decades ago. Since 2003, Turkey has been governed by the Justice and Development Party of Erdogan. This is a party with Islamist roots. And Turkey, under Erdogan, has been a kind of a hybrid regime, democratic in that the Justice and Development Party gained power in free and fair elections, but also leaning toward Islamism because Erdogan and his circle want some of the laws of Turkey to derive from Islam. They reject explicitly the old secular model of Ataturk. So Turkey is a hybrid regime, and like Iran, Turkey was doing pretty well in the first decade of the 21st century, high economic growth, lots of soft power. It even looked like about a decade or more ago, Turkey might be joining the European Union. But over the last several months, Turkey has been lurching toward authoritarianism. If you read the headlines, Erdogan is taking out political opponents. He's sounding a lot less liberal than he used to. We're dealing with a moving target in Turkey, and I'm not foolish enough to predict what's going to happen within Turkey or to Erdogan. But I would say watch Turkey because it's telling us something about the possibility for a hybrid democratic Islamist regime. And I'm afraid Turkey's current path bodes ill for that hybrid. It looks like it's hard for Islamists to remain democratic, at least in Turkey. And that probably was the case in Egypt as well, which had a Muslim Brotherhood government that was overthrown in 2013.
Yeah, both of those cases are on the hot button watch list right now in terms of our State Department, but as well as the news and scholars' agendas as well. So it is something that we will be watching very closely, and your book really does help to inform the way that we should be watching all of these events with an eye to the future, but also an eye to the past. And again, I recommend this book. We didn't cover everything in it, but I urge everybody to get out there and buy it because it is a wonderful read. The last question I want to finish with, and I often do this with our guest on the show, is to add your reflections on the process of writing the book. You had mentioned that this idea was kicking around in your head a little bit when you were writing some of your earlier works, and so it had a couple years to gestate. And was there anything that you learned that surprised you or that changed your mind throughout this entire process?
Well, one thing was I was surprised. I canvassed lots of debate, current debates on Islamism, and the thing that really surprised me most, I think, was just how robust this conviction, that Western people have, and you know, I share this to some extent, but it's something I mentioned a minute ago. Islamism just can't work, and it's going to go away. It can't work because it's backward looking. It's full of ideological zeal, but if Islamists start to run a country, they realize they have to be pragmatic. You know, there's this it's called the garbage collection theory of government. You know, it's one thing to say we're going to bring heaven to earth, we're going to restore the greatness of our ancestors. It's another thing if you're actually running a country and you have to collect the garbage and you have to, you know, deal with the real world. There's a lot to that thesis. In fact, there's an article in the Washington Post yesterday about how ISIS is having a lot of trouble governing cities in Iraq that it is dominating. However, that doesn't mean ISIS is doomed, and it certainly doesn't mean Islamism is doomed. The ideology just has so much momentum now, and so I came into the project thinking, well, you know, a lot of people will say Islamism is doomed, but surely lots will say, no, it's going to go on for a long time. I had more trouble than I thought, finding people who would say Islamism is going to be around for a long time. There are some people who say that, but it's harder to find them than I thought. And, of course, I'm not able to pinpoint when Islamism is going to die off. I'm not even willing to say it ever will die off. But history convinces me, again, that we analysts have serious biases when we look at an ideology that we don't share. And, Tony, you mentioned analogous bias that a lot of scholars, social scientists take toward religion. I think that's a really apt comparison. And that's again, that, if I had to name one thing that surprised me most, it's just how almost invincible that conviction is among a lot of scholars.
Well, it is a lesson for scholars and for everyone else as well, and it's very enlightening to have you on the program today. My guest today has been John Owen. John, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.